Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest news on the cliffhanger over the so-called fiscal cliff that has America's elected representatives entangled in a drama of their own making while they haggle over the last minute over doing their job, which apparently, unlike the rest of us, they are exempt from having to perform or be fired. Paul Glastris, the editor of the Washington Monthly, joins us to try and make sense of what is happening or not on Capitol Hill. Then we'll hear from Harvard economist Richard Parker, the co-founder of Mother Jones, who serves on the editorial board of The Nation. We'll discuss how President Obama has skillfully played the public relations game against boneheaded Republican ideologues, but at the same time, while trying to avert a self-inflicted wound on the American economy, the overall damage to the already tatted image of government sinks from dismay to disgust. Then finally, we'll examine the secrecy surrounding the deteriorating health of the Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez with Caracas-based journalist Virginia Lopez, who covers Latin America and Venezuela for Britain's Guardian newspaper and Sky TV. We will discuss the very real possibility that President Chavez has days or weeks to live and whether his anointed Vice President Nicolas Maduro will be able to win a new 6-year term if the popular and charismatic leader is not inaugurated as planned on January the 10th. Joining us now is Paul Glastris, the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly and a senior fellow at the Western Policy Center in Washington, D.C. From September 1998 to January 2001, he was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton. He wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to healthcare to the budget. Before joining the White House, Paul Glastris spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News & World Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Glastris.
Great to be here.
And obviously, I'm grateful, Paul, and Happy New Year to you that you're spending New Year's Eve with us here instead of toasting. But what is there to toast in Washington, D.C.?
Well, I can't say there's a lot to toast. I suppose there's a flicker of hope that today and yesterday, but fundamentally today, a kind of a sort of a deal was worked out between Vice President Biden and Senate Minority Leader McConnell on a tax deal that isn't going to get voted on, but there seems to be some agreement. We don't know whether it'll pass the House, but there is a quasi deal, so something's happened. But fundamentally, we are going over the fiscal cliff. And I think we're going to find out it wasn't much of a cliff, you know, a little step maybe. You know, enough progress that people feel that the work was not for naught, but not enough to actually relax about.
So, and not enough for us to be able to report categorically because we don't know what the deal is.
Well, we know the outlines of the deal, but there's some big gaps, some crucial information that's missing. So what's the basis of the deal? In its simplest form, the president had said he wanted taxes to stay the same for everyone under all income under $250,000. Now that has been raised to $450,000, which means under this deal, income above $450,000 gets taxed at the pre-Bush tax cut rate of 39.5%, the old Clinton administration rate. There's also an increase in the in dividend taxation, capital gains taxation, and so what the president did was relent a little bit on that upper income number. What he got in return were things that were very important to him and to the economy of the American people. He got an extension of unemployment insurance. He got an extension of a number of tax credits that are extremely valuable for the working poor. He got a fix on the minimum tax problem, the alternative minimum tax. So things that are necessary to keep the economy going, stimulus type stuff, that's what he gave in return. That's about it. It's a very simple tit for tat. They got something, the president got something. But the big issue is these sequestration, the $1 trillion of spending cuts that are supposed to begin to go into effect beginning tomorrow. It's unclear what the deal is with them, whether it is part of the deal or not. And it's unclear whether the House, without those sequestration dealt with in this deal between McConnell and the president, will support it. Many House members, Republicans, are saying they won't. So what we have is a somewhat verbal agreement between the Republicans in the Senate, and the Democrats will go along with this, and the White House, but really no indication from the House whether they'll accept it or not.
Again, I'm speaking with Paul Glastras, the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly and a senior fellow at the Western Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and a former special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton. And prior to that, he spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News and World Report. So we have a deal, but we don't have a deal because the Republican House has not signed off on it. Obviously, Harry Reid's been cut out of the deal because the negotiations took place between apparently old friends, Joe Biden, the vice president, and Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader. I noticed early in the day that Harry Reid looked a bit surly. His feelings are a little bit bruised. But then, as I mentioned in the opening, Paul, my sense is that the American people are pretty disgusted with this whole thing.
Well, and they have a right to be. I suppose a lot of the disgust is different depending on which side of the aisle you're on. For a Republican, the disgust might be that taxes are going up, but there's been no agreement on spending coming down. For a Democrat, the disgust would be, hey, the president won a pretty substantial victory on the promise of tax increases on income above $250,000, and he's already had to relent on that, and we haven't even gotten to the tough stuff, which is entitlements and so forth. So why a victory doesn't succeed in getting more than this is something that a lot of people on the left are saying.
Well, it's been pretty clear, at least to me, Paul Glastras, that the Republicans in the House have essentially, basically, been pretty disingenuous because if they go over the cliff, which apparently they have, and that in itself is a sort of artificial construct. It has all kinds of apocalyptic overtones, but it stems from an earlier Tea Party tantrum over the debt ceiling, which led to the sequester and has led to this situation. And we don't know whether or not, as we approach a new debt ceiling in the next coming weeks, whether there will be a similar tantrum from the Tea Party. But it looks as though they've been happy to let this so-called ship of state go over the so-called fiscal cliff, because on January the 3rd, in the new Congress, they can argue that they're not dealing with tax increases, but in fact with tax cuts.
Well, that's exactly right, and the flip side is, let's just be perfectly clear, the person with the whip hand in this whole thing is President Obama. And it's not because he won a big victory. I don't think that's the thing that's impressing members of Republicans in the House. What the big thing is that, as you said, the tax rates revert to the old Clinton rates at midnight tonight. And that was the leverage that the president had to get what deal he got, if it's a deal. Absent that leverage, then they had no interest in passing something that allowed upper income rates to go up. So the real question is, that piece of leverage will be used either tonight or over the next few days, presumably we get a deal. Then we go into the issue of the debt ceiling. And the president has said he's not going to allow that to be a bargaining chip. I think we know the Republicans are willing to let it be a bargaining chip. And so we just don't know how far they'll go in that direction. And the other interesting thing that happened today is in his press conference speech, the president said something that really infuriated the Republicans. He said, when they go to that second round of negotiations, he's going to want revenue on the table. So, in other words, if they cut a deal to cut spending, he's going to be asking for more tax increases. And he said on a one-to-one basis. That might come in the form of closing loopholes or something, but he wants more revenue on the table. Republicans are screaming that that's a new demand. And the Democrats are saying no. He had said he wanted $1.6 trillion in revenue. He only got seven. He wants, you know, he wants the other the rest of that money. So he seems to be taking a very bold, strong position on these next rounds after this one.
So, Paul Glashruss, how much is the bully pulpit working? Because, you know, a lot of pundits said at the time when the Tea Party caucus were threatening the full faith and credit of the United States to get their way, which led to the sequester and led to this current situation, they weren't really punished like they were when Gingrich pulled a similar stunt in terms of brinkmanship, and that apparently led to a victory for Clinton. It didn't translate that way. Some people have argued that one of the main reasons why it didn't is that we have a convention in our press of equal and opposite arguments, whether or not it's flagrantly apparent that one side is misbehaving and the other's not. The president, in fact, in his interview with David Gregory on Meet the Press on Sunday, sort of implored the press to have that pox on both their houses attitude. Is there any chance that the American people are going to be sufficiently upset with the Tea Party misbehavior to boot these people out in their highly gerrymandered seats?
Well, I think it's a little early to say. Let me say that if you look at the polling data, the Republicans did pay a price for almost driving the country off the cliff. The Democrats came out looking not good, but better than the Republicans, and all the polling has shown that if there's not a deal on this fiscal cliff issue, they will blame the Republicans at considerably higher level than they blame the Democrats or the president. So the Republicans are paying a price in the polls, but they're not paying a price with their voters. That's the big difference. And so they don't... You have House members in winning 60, 70% margins in their districts in an election, this last election, where Obama won 53% of the vote. And you have senators who won handily in Republican-leaning states. So they're not feeling a lot of pressure from swing voters. But to the extent that there are middle voters, I think they have been siding with the president, and I think they will do so even more if this issue doesn't go through. And I think the president will gain points in the minds of the American people if he pulls off this deal.
So, do you think then does this therefore come down to 2014? Because 2010 caught the Democrats by surprise, and you know the victory that Karl Rove and others engineered, largely financed, I understand, by the American Petroleum Institute, but they very cleverly targeted the swing states and the state government, governors, the legislatures and the governorships, and won and were able to change a lot of the electoral map to essentially consolidate their victory in the House. So you do have a very divided government, and it's highly gerrymandered, as we both agree. But it's not going to change unless, you know, there's a similar effort on the part of the Democrats to match what Karl Rove did in 2010, which I assume, given the enormous money at their disposal, the Republicans are prepared to do again in 2014.
Well, I'm not sure it was. They certainly had a big year in 2010, but you know, the midterm elections favor Republican favor Republicans because the people who come out to vote in midterm elections tend to be older, whiter people. General elections tend to bring out younger and people of color. And so we saw that Obama had a big advantage in 2012. My guess is, just as in 2010, the Republicans will have an advantage in 2014. But, you know, they can push it too far, Ian. You'll recall in 2008, a year like 2014, the midterm election and the second term of a president, going back to 1816, presidents always lose in those by-year elections. In 1998, after he was impeached and the Republicans overreached, Bill Clinton actually won 5 seats in the House. So we shall see. It really does. The public may surprise us, and Obama may have enough savvy to play off Republican overreach, where 2014 won't be as bad as a lot of people, you know, sort of assume.
Well, I brought it up, Paul Glashaw, because it seems to me that that we're going to be in for gridlock for the next 2 years. Isn't that pretty clear? That this is not going away, that this deal, whatever it is if it's even dealt with in the next few days, starting on January the 3rd with the new Congress, almost immediately we're going to have another crisis over the debt ceiling, which has never happened before. But, you know, since the Tea Party came into our politics, they've decided to seize on this as a perennial issue. I see a blood sport until some kind of resolution in 2014, which would, in fact, require the president, as you say, you know, in a presidential election, the young and the minorities come out to vote. Well, unless the young and minorities come out to vote in 2014, I don't think anything's going to be done for the next 4 years.
Well, it's going to be tough. But remember, there are. A lot of what Barack Obama needs to accomplish over the next 4 years is to seal and cement the victories of the previous 4 years. So most of the regulations that need to be written for the big legislative successes of the first 4 years, I'm talking about the Dodd-Frank financial Wall Street reform measure, I'm talking the Obamacare, the health care, most of those regulations are still in the works. The fact that Barack Obama is in the White House, in control of the agencies, that's really where a lot of the what progress we have will happen, is in putting out those regulations, managing the rollout of Obamacare, managing the rollout of the new regulations on Wall Street, and doing what he can to firm up the economy. And then I think you're going to see a president who turns, as most do in their second term, to foreign affairs, and possibly trying to pass some trade deals that for once do some good for the average American, and trying to shore up that economy. And the stronger the economy is over the next 4 years, the stronger the hand that Barack Obama will have. And I think there could be some movement on some legislation. Immigration reform is one of them. But I think you're right. In general, we are looking at gridlock, and unless there's some break in 2014 that hands the House to the Democrats, which seems extremely unlikely, I don't see how you break out of that.
Well, Paul Glashaw, I thank you so much for joining us here on New Year's Eve.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, Paul. Again, I've been speaking with Paul Glashaw, who's the Editor-in-Chief of the Washington Monthly and a Senior Fellow at the Western Policy Center in Washington, D.C. He served as a Special Assistant and Senior Speechwriter to President Bill Clinton, and before joining the White House, he spent 10 years as a Correspondent and Editor at U.S. News and World Report. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Harvard economist Richard Parker. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He's the former managing editor of Ramparts, was co-founder of Mother Jones Magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Parker.
Nice to be with you, Ian, as always.
And Happy New Year to you, Richard. And this fiscal cliff business has gone from theater of the absurd to to theater of the fatuous. I mean, there isn't a deal, but if there is a deal, we don't know whether the Republicans will sign off on it, and we are going over the cliff. But then the obstructionists are going to be rewarded because they wanted this all along.
Right. So, you know, this has been in the making for at least a couple of years, and it stems from a couple of things, one of which is that we're at the tail end of a long Republican cycle in which the natural right to reduce taxes on the very wealthy has been taken as canonical. And the problem is that the meltdown of financial markets over the last several years has created such an enormous hole in the federal budget so that we're spending about a quarter of GDP through the federal government. We're taking in about 15% of GDP, and so there's a huge gap, and this has to be closed. It doesn't have to be closed right away, but you don't want to run this forever. I'm a progressive Keynesian, but you don't want to run deficits forever, but that isn't the issue. The issue is that you're having a contest of wills between different classes and regions and worldviews, and short of restarting the American Civil War, this is, I think, what it looks like, that we're going to have rhetorical civil war now for the next several years while we try to figure out what direction the country's going in.
Well, I was mentioning to our previous guest, the editor of the Washington Monthly, that I don't think anything is going to change until 2014, if indeed the Republicans pay a price for what they've done, and they didn't pay a price when they first threatened the debt ceiling and had their tantrum, which led to the sequester and the current situation we're in, largely, I think, because our press is so even-handed that it assigns blame ritually to both sides, and it was so clear who was at fault there, and they're going to try it again, presumably. So unless Obama weighs in 2014 and gets the young and the minorities out to vote as he did this time in 2012, nothing's going to change, surely.
Well, you know, again, I mean, a month before the election in October, it looked very much like Obama was in deep trouble and likely to lose. And, in fact, his constituencies did show up to vote. And it's not clear to me that they showed up because they were mobilized by him, but whether they were mobilized by an ideal that caused them to turn out and vote for him as the lesser of the two evils as far as they were concerned. I think that we've got voters that are actually fairly mobilized in the center and on the left side of the political spectrum these days, and understand that this is a long, hard ground combat that is not going to be over soon, and that the idea that there's an election or a candidate who can be elected who can wave a congressional or a presidential wand over America and push us through this to some land beyond is nonsense. This is what American politics looks like and is going to look like for the next several years. And I think that rather than lament it, we ought to embrace it and make clear to those we're struggling with that we're here for the struggle and we intend to win.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's a former managing editor of Ramparts and was co-founder of Mother Jones Magazine and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. So what kind of a Pyrrhic victory are we talking about here, though, in terms of President Obama skillfully having played the public relations game against these boneheaded Republican ideologues? But it seems to me that while he's tried to avert a self-inflicted wound on the American economy, there is nevertheless an overall damage to the already tattered image of government, which is sinking from dismay to disgust.
Well, I mean, you know, again, the public approval rates of members of Congress, like of journalism, is so low now. It's not clear to me that dropping another couple of percentage points makes all that amount of difference. And it isn't, again, a question of being able to live with or without the confidence of the mainstream media. This is one of those political moments where I think that, you know, we've had now two elections where we have put Democrat in the White House, and while he may not be the Democrat that all Democrats wish he was, I think that it's a sign of this larger demographic and political shift that is going on in the country, in which this long conservative Reagan cycle is coming to an end. And what we need to be focused on is how to push forward on that victory. There's nothing we can do about lamenting what is. It is that we have to push on further beyond it. And I think that what we've got here in the deal that they'll come out with is more revenue. It will mean a reduction for spending on Medicare and Medicaid and probably Social Security. It does take tax rates up a bit, not nearly as much as they should, and certainly not corporate tax rates up as much as they should. And it doesn't address the question of how to force repatriation of overseas profits that are being held by U.S. corporations, oftentimes in places like the Cayman Islands. These are fundamental structural questions. But, you know, I went to see Lincoln not long ago, and I'm of a mind that we're going to have to figure out how to make gains yard by yard rather than expect that there is going to be some moment where some president that is not on the horizon is going to arrive and save us from the legacy of the last 30 years.
So, Richard Parker, is this Social Security, the chained, what's it called? It's CPI, I think it's called.
Chained CPI, right.
Is that really the end of the world? I mean, I had a guest on yesterday who suggested that Social Security had indeed been looted for the last several decades by the government. They've been borrowing against it and using up the surplus, and that indeed we are going to have to raise revenues in order to pay out what we owe and what we promised.
Yeah, so yeah, here's the way I try to help my students think about it. And I teach a course, in fact, starts in a couple of weeks, called President's Politics and Economic Growth from Franklin Roosevelt to Barack Obama. And it's a survey of the last 65 years of different presidents and their strategies toward economic growth. Think of it this way. At the beginning of the 20th century, the federal government was probably all of about 2 or 3% of GDP, and all government, federal, state, and local, was maybe 10, 11% of GDP. Right now it's about 40%. Normally it's down in the low 30% total federal, state, and local. But that puts us at the low end of all the advanced industrial countries of the world. And the average share of government in GDPs of the advanced, prosperous countries of the world that have higher median incomes, higher performance in terms of school-aged children, greater longevity, greater quality of life, all of them spend somewhere between 40 and 45% of GDP through the public sector. And, you know, we need, as progressives, to focus less on, are we holding the line on Social Security? Are we holding the line on Medicare? Social Security and Medicare do need significant reforms. Medicare, most of all, we should not be spending 17% of GDP on health care in the United States, of which Medicare is a part. The average for the advanced industrial countries is more like 10% or 11%. So right there, there's 6% of GDP, and that's a lot of money when you're talking about a $15 trillion GDP. That's a lot of money that could be rechanneled from a more fairly, not just efficiently, but more fairly organized healthcare system. And we don't want to be in the business of playing hold the line. We need to be out there challenging the government on our own to reform healthcare and to also reform Social Security. How would I reform Social Security? I'd lift the cap on contributions. Right now, as you know, we only pay into Social Security on wage income, not on non-wage income like capital gains or interest. And also, we only pay up to the first 100,000 of earnings. And so if I'm a congressman making 200,000, my effective Social Security tax rate is half that of a worker who's earning $50,000 a year, and that's just not fair. We've lifted the cap on Medicare contributions. We ought to be lifting the cap on Social Security contributions. As for what we need to do about Medicare and medical spending in general, well, I think they're going to look at the Canadian system and starting to the debate all over again about why we need single payer and why we're paying too much for administrative costs and for drug treatments that have dubious effectiveness and certainly are dubious in terms of effectiveness to cost, would be a great starting place. Again, I think that rather than adopt the Maginot line of we will hold them here, we actually need to be thinking about what our own blitzkrieg would look like and start to roll eastward across the plains of Belgium.
Well, that's always puzzled me, Richard Parker, is if a group of right-wing zealots can capture the Republican Party in the name of populism and outrage against Wall Street and then turn out to be an astroturf bunch of functionaries for the oligarchs.
They're hirelings
of the oligarchs. Why can't progressives capture the Democratic Party? I've never understood that.
Well, I mean, look, politics runs in cycles, and we have lived through this 30-year-long cycle of conservative hegemonic narrative. Now, we're not going to look to the mainstream media to solve our problems for us, but the great contribution of the Internet over the last 30 years is it's created an enormous platform of communication and cable television and all sorts of other things have added to the number of voices in the society. I actually think that's why we've been able to win the elections that we have been in the last few years, and why it is that you now see the coalescence of a coalition of people of color and the young that are actually starting to make a difference in a number of key states across the U.S. And again, I am optimistic about the direction in which that politics is going to move over the next few years. I think that we have every opportunity to press forward in this party saying, look, we're not just the votes, we're also the volunteer labor, and we're also a significant amount of the money that the party needs to operate, and we're mobilizing now to put up candidates that are the antithesis of the Rahm Emanuel-style candidates who were chosen because they had high net worth and could finance their own campaigns. We need to be thinking about how to put more of our own people up on the hustings to run strong campaigns that make a common sense argument for why progressive solutions are the only way out of the dilemma that 30 years of conservatism have put us in.
So, Richard Parker, at the risk of sounding like every other journalist, which, since I'm in the alternative media, I shudder to think that I could possibly be doing that. Although my many critics think I do, the ritual now is what was the big game changer in 2012, the best right. and the worst and all that nonsense. But right. to my mind, there's no question that the tape that Mother Jones, and of course you're a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine.
Sure.
The tape that they somehow procured of Mitt Romney at that fundraiser clearly was a major game changer. Would you agree?
Oh, I would. And I'm very proud of my offspring in that sense. Very, very proud. I've had several conversations with staff out there since and have given a couple of talks and a number of interviews here to just help them out on the East Coast. I'm very proud of what they did, obviously.
Well, is there anything else that comes to mind? Because my sense is that the least reported story was the extraordinary tape that Bob Woodward revealed of Fox News soliciting General Petraeus to run for president, which the Post buried in the style section, and nobody in the mainstream media picked up on it.
You know, Ian, when you say that, I'm reminded of what I.F. Stone said to me once about 40 years ago. He and I were talking in Washington, and I was explaining to him the concept of Mother Jones. He said, Richard, the thing I love about the Washington Post is that I never know every day where I'll find a front page story. I think you just illustrated that tradition goes on to have the Petraeus story buried in the style section. It's a classic but not unfamiliar Washington Post habit. So, again, I mean, look, I think that we've come through this election with a stronger Democratic delegation in the House and a strong delegation in the Senate. I mean, we've got Elizabeth Warren coming into the Senate from here in Massachusetts. I think we are going to get some kind of change around this.
Filibuster, you mean?
On the filibuster rule, sorry about that.
Yeah.
I'm a little blank moment. On the filibuster rule, and I think that those kinds of subtle rule changes actually are going to change some of the ground game of politics in Washington in the coming year. I don't think, in fact, we're going to have to wait for 2014 to see change. Now, again, how hard that's pressed depends on the fight that the president is willing to put up. I think he actually sounded kind of awkward and nerdy to me. I mean, I apologize that I thought it was kind of silly the way they planned this press conference to have a bunch of middle class Americans standing around and cheerleading because it was so patent. And yet, on the other hand, it is a signal from him that he's willing to fight every day and every way against the Republicans in the Congress. And you know, it may not be as much as we want, it may not be what we want, but it's a sign that in his second term, he actually is going to behave more aggressively. He's going to come out of that cocoon of his and actually act more like Lyndon Johnson and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and that will be a plus for all the rest of us.
Well, one hopes, and one also hopes that there's sufficient outrage in the American public about the fact that the Republicans are prepared to destroy our economy in order to save tax cuts for the millionaires and billionaires. It's so patently obvious.
I don't think they're going to destroy the economy. I actually think that we're about to enter into a significant growth period. I mean, there's so much capital that is sitting on the sidelines waiting to come in. And you can see that the consumer confidence level has been rising, even though it dips back easily. We've seen Europe survive, which no one expected that Europe would 2 years ago. Rather than anticipate that this Republican intransigence is going to wreck the economy, I think the economy is actually going to perform fairly decently despite the Republicans. And that, contrary to what we might think, this is actually going to work toward our benefit because it's going to give people a greater sense of hope ahead. And I think what we have to do is continually insist that this growth is coming because of the hard decisions that were made over the last 4 years, and that what we now need is more reform. We need to hear more from this newly elected Senator Warren about what needs to change in the financial markets. I am not by any means willing to give up on the struggle for financial market reform because that's where I've put so much of my energy over the last 4 years. I'm not pleased with the way that Dodd-Frank has turned out. And yet at the same time, I do think that these continuous missteps by these big financial firms, the LIBOR crisis, the various kinds of crises that have surfaced in the markets, have actually strengthened the backbone of regulators in the shadows that we need to be paying more attention to and applauding and celebrating and pushing forward. I think that there's an opportunity right now for us to pivot off of the fiscal cliff and start to instead focus on who's going to be the next head of the SEC, who's going to head up the CFTC, who's going to be the next attorney general, who is going to be the deputy attorney general under this new guy who's going to head up civil rights. I'm sorry, not civil rights, but antitrust.
Sure.
There are a lot of opportunities for pushing candidates beyond us focusing just on this deficit deal that we ought to be involved in. There's a way in which we allow ourselves to be seduced by the mainstream media into thinking that we have to win the game on the field that they've defined. I think we have to play on the field that they've defined, and we have to fight on the field that they've defined, but we simultaneously need to be pushing in areas that aren't being discussed by progressives, and I'm sure they're being discussed on your program, but aren't being discussed enough in other places. It talks about a broader landscape of the things that we can be doing over the next 2 or 3 years to make 2016 much more positive for us. Because I do think that the opportunity is there.
Well, Richard Parker, I thank you so much for joining us here today, and Happy New Year to you.
Well, Happy New Year. Let's look for a better New Year next year.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He's a former managing editor of Ramparts, co-founder of Mother Jones, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll back and go to Caracas, Venezuela. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Virginia Lopez, a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom and for Britain's Sky TV. Welcome to Background Briefing, Virginia Lopez.
Hi, how are you?
And I believe that things are very quiet in Venezuela and Caracas, where you are now, which people are taking the Christmas and New Year's holidays, but fairly momentous events going on in Cuba in terms of the health of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. My sources tell me that he's only got days to live or weeks to live. He's in a terminal phase. What are you hearing in terms of Venezuelan media?
We actually haven't had too much information being disclosed. The Minister of Information and the Vice President have given weekly updates on President Chavez's health, but we haven't seen or heard from Chavez himself. And we have certainly don't know, you know, whether this is terminal or whether he will come back. Messages sort of differ from, you know, unending optimism to like you say, rumors that maybe this has taken a turn for the worse.
So what official announcements have there been then?
Well, last night, Vice President Maduro spoke from Havana saying that President Chavez had a new complication resulting from a respiratory infection that was being treated, and that itself was a complication from this very sort of complex surgery that President Chavez underwent, I guess about 2 weeks ago. But like I said, no, you know, nothing too detailed other than referring to the surgery as very complex and with risks. There haven't been any medical report or any official medical record released of any kind.
So Chavez's eldest daughter, Rose, is there, is she not? And along with his son-in-law?
His daughter and yes, and his son-in-law appeared yesterday. They were sort of sitting side by side with Nicolás Maduro, the vice president. But from what I heard in yesterday's report, all of his children are there with him. So he's in the company of his children.
So, what from a Venezuelan's point of view, though, this at least it strikes me as being a little odd. That the president of a country should first of all be getting all of his medical treatment in another country, and the Venezuelan people have never been told what's been going on really with the health of their president, and now that there's a possibility he may die in Cuba and not in his homeland, that strikes me as being a little odd.
Yes, it's of course very hard to understand, especially from somebody who has always, you know, expressed such fervor towards Venezuela. Well, you know, when he constantly refers to Venezuela as a fatherland, you know, and he's supposed to be heading this new Bolivarian-inspired movement. But the truth is that I think Venezuelans have sort of, he's an incredibly charismatic leader. I think Venezuelans understand that this is an illness that is probably graver than we're being led to believe. And so there's been a bit of a respect, I would say. I don't know what the right word would be, towards President Chavez's decision to get treatment in Cuba. Because the whole thing has been framed almost sort of as a state secret. I think people have sort of excused the fact that you know, that he needs his privacy, and there hasn't really been sort of a major outrage. There's been some voices from the opposition asking for medical records and asking for, you know, an official report. But again, because Chavez had been in since this illness began 18 months ago, so intent on you know, keeping it secret, and also every time there was some sort of like demand for an official record, he'd accuse the opposition of being, you know, sort of having morbid curiosity. I think the claims from the opposition sort of quieted down, and at this point, you know, there's this sort of like disbelief that Chavez is getting treated in a different country, but there isn't really, you know, like a sort of uproar at the national level because of it. If anything, it's the opposite, really. It's a sort of like a undying show of support for the leader, and there's been an incredible show of like almost religious fervor, and there's, you know, these collective prayers being held in a lot of the city squares. Even at the international level, Evo Morales had like a vigil held for Chavez's health. You know, there's all sorts of like media movements and Twitters being sent in support of the president. So yeah, it's been quite the tumultuous end of the year.
Again, I'm speaking with Virginia Lopez, who's in Caracas, Venezuela. She's a local Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom and for Britain's Sky TV. And we're talking about the health of the president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, who is in Cuba, where his health has apparently taken a turn for the worst. The vice president went on, as Virginia explained, went on national television last night from Havana, talking about the president having new complications. And he went on to say, thanks to his physical and spiritual strength, Comandante Chavez is facing this difficult situation. However, the details are not very clear. Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia, has also been in Havana, has he not?
Yes, he went about, I want to say last week, he went to visit President Chavez from Bolivia, yes. But there were no details released on the visit. Okay. Correa, who had been to visit Chavez right before the fourth surgery in December, did see Chavez, and they were able to sort of have a conversation, and Correa was actually crucial in informing people that the surgery was quite complicated, that it was with its challenges, and that, you know, that this was a very trying moment for the president. But actually, from Evo Morales' visit, there's been, you know, very little said, if anything at all.
So, Virginia Lopez, again, Caracas-based journalist, we're talking about the apparently deteriorating health of Hugo Chavez, who's sought treatment in Cuba for some time, and the only official statement so far is that there are new complications. But given that his entire family is there with him, or most of his family is there with him, the very least you can say, surely, is that he's probably not going to be able to make the inauguration on January the 10th, being sworn in for a new six-year term, which he just won handily in a recent election.
There's a lot of speculation that he won't be able to be present for for the swearing-in ceremony on the 10th, on January 10th. That's when it's scheduled for. But there's also been a lot of talk here about the possibility of postponing that date. Constitutionally, there had been, you know, the Constitution is states that that the date should not be, that if the president is not able to be sworn in, elections are to be called within a 30-day period or so following the date that he's unable to govern. But the president of the National Assembly and a close Chavez ally has also been saying that there's sort of like that the wording in the Constitution is actually not entirely clear, and that Chavez could very easily either be sworn elsewhere, so maybe he, you know, we'll be seeing him be sworn into office in Cuba, or that this date could be postponed. So again, you know, a huge amount of uncertainty revolving around whether Chavez will be sworn in or not. There was this possibility opened that maybe he would, that this date could be postponed, and that the place was to be determined.
So what's happening with the opposition? Opposition leader who lost the last election, the Chavez's party challenged him very much for the gubernatorial elections, which were recently conducted. He managed to win his governorship. So he's now a viable opposition candidate, is he not?
Very much so. I think he did a wonderful campaign, and certainly he's been the one person to come closest to Chavez in any election. I think the opposition feels a bit divided at the moment, which is a shame, because it took a lot of effort to finally unite or rally behind Capriles. Capriles did manage to win the governorship of Miranda in the latest governor elections or regional elections. Chavez's party won 20 of the 23 regional or governorships. So again, he's, you know, like I said, his party counts with a great deal of support here in Venezuela. But Capriles, in most polls that were conducted before the elections, it always came first whenever he was compared to to any other candidate from Chavismo that wasn't Chavez himself. So if there were to be snap elections and Capriles had to run as the opposition candidate against one of Chavez's partners in his party, you know, you could see him win. But again, you know, it's unpredictable. It would be snap elections with not a lot of time to campaign. Chavez already named Nicolás Maduro, who's the current vice president, as his sort of natural successor. And Maduro is also quite charismatic. So again, it's all very uncertain.
Well, but it's hard to imagine Chavismo without Chavez, and the Bolivarian Revolution without its spearhead, you know. My understanding is that Vice President Nicolas Maduro is he that highly regarded? He's been, you know, somewhat in the shadows, hasn't he? I didn't get the impression that he was a very charismatic character. You just said he is, but nobody is even approaching Chavez's popularity.
Bueno, yes, I agree completely with you. I think that we could see Chavismo with Chavez, just as in Argentina people still see Peronismo without Perón, but I don't think that we'll see a political figure like Chavez anytime soon, either coming from the opposition or from Chavismo himself. Chavismo itself. Maduro is, it is said that he's popular amongst the basis in Chavismo. It's hard to say because he's been Minister of Foreign Affairs for so long. He hasn't really been part of the national scene. But counting with Chavez's support, or this sort of anointment that, you know, that Chavez did in public television, I think would probably benefit Maduro in a race. I don't know. I don't know how it would be. I don't know how this sort of period of national mourning would affect, you know, an election. I think that if there would be snap elections within 30 days, I think it is sort of like, you know, huge emotional outpour of emotion. I think Maduro might benefit from the sympathy vote and just from association with Chavez. You know, Chavez was so clear in naming him his preferred successor and in asking people to vote for him that I would imagine that his supporters would do so.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Virginia Lopez.
Of course.
Again, I've been speaking with Virginia Lopez, who's a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom and for Britain's Sky TV. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Jose Benavides. And I wish you all a very happy new year, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.